Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome back to Mountain Comics, proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this month for our final episode is our very first guest in the first episode of Mountain Comics, the irredeemable Shag. Hi, Shag. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. I am really happy to be here. I see you've picked up lots of knickknacks in the cabin since I was here last. You just start filling the space, I guess.
Yeah, you go to all the tourist traps and you buy candles and all this other bric-a-brac over the course of 57 other episodes that we've done on the show. So yeah, I had always wanted to do, anyone looking at the show knows we're here to talk about Alpha Flight number 4.
Woohoo!
And yeah. And Shag and I talked about an issue of Alpha Flight, as I just mentioned, on the first episode. And when I was sort of figuring out what books I wanted to fit in the final season, I realized I wanted to get to this Alpha Flight. And it just, as George Lucas says, it all rhymes. I was like, oh, this is perfect. Shag was on the first show to talk about Alpha Flight. Let's have him on the last episode to talk about Alpha Flight. Now, you were on the show one other time where we talked about your other favorite, Micronauts. Did that as well.
That's right. But, so good.
Yeah. But I just figured it's just too perfect to not end the show, like I mentioned last week, end the show. The penultimate episode was with Ryan. He was the guest star, second episode, and now we're wrapping up with Shag. So thank you for coming back one final time.
We call it synergy in the biz, sir. I got to ask, though. So, all right, last time we covered number 40 of Alpha Flight. This is not the first episode. This time we're covering number 4. How many years are in between that, and like how many years did you go to the Poconos on vacation?
Well, okay. I mean, we went to the Poconos from the first year I was born. So that would have been, I was born in 71 and we went in 72. So we went every year from 72 through 1988.
Wow.
And then I went one or two more years during the Joe Kubert years. At that point, I was feeling like an adult. And like, oh, I'm too cool for this. So like, there was one year where I think I went the summer of the first year of Kubert, and then the second year my sister had come to live with us, and I think I stayed home, and then she and I drove up ourselves for like a week, and then I think that might have been it. So basically, 72 through 89, and then like kind of a half one the next year, and then I think that was it.
Wow. I didn't realize you had gone for that long. That's amazing. Okay. Yeah.
Every
that
year.
The 36 issue gap there. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And it's, I loved sort of tracking that of like looking that we talked about last week with Night Force, where I was like, oh, I love Night Force number 4. I would have kept buying this, but Night Force was canceled by the time I got to the book. So, okay. Alpha Flight. And this is not meant as a knock to that first issue that we covered. Because, but I was not buying Alpha Flight by that point. I only bought Alpha Flight number 40 back then because I was buying every comic I could get my hands on because I needed so many more comics. By this point, I had given up on the book. But at this run, I will. You know, realize you're the bigger fan, so maybe this is just kind of like, you know, this isn't objectively true. But to me, the first 12. Burns Alpha Flight, or verse 13 or 14 that he did, are like, that's the thing for me. That's the thing. And so I never missed an issue of Alpha Flight when he was doing it in this first year, because I love this to pieces.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that issue 12 is where it all peaks, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that is the moment in Alpha Flight that they just keep, they've been chasing it for 40 years. They keep coming back to that story beat. So I wouldn't necessarily say the first 12 are everything. I would say the first 28. The Burton run, without a doubt, is the best.
Right.
And if you go past 12, you get to see Heather begin to develop as a character, which is great. So I think the first 28 are all solid. 12 is certainly the peak, though. So that's fair.
Okay. All right. And it's after Byrne is when they did the switchover with the Hulk creative team, right? Who took over as the writer?
Bill Mantlow. And he wrote it for quite a while, actually. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, did you stay with Alpha Flight till the very end? Because it ran for what? Like 70 issues? Something like
130.
It ran 130?
Yeah, but by the end, nobody was reading it. Don't worry.
Oof.
I'll tell you my history fairly quickly on Alpha Flight then. So, no, I did not start that. I didn't start until issue 87, believe it or not.
Oh
That's
my
when I started buying.
goodness.
So,
Wow.
but growing up, and you love these stories, on the bus, school bus with my friends, they
Oh
would
God.
tell me, I know, they would tell me all about these amazing Marvel comics they were reading. Alpha Flight was in
Unbelievable.
the mix. You know, they were never headliners, right? But they would tell me legendary stories about Vindicator, you know, coming from Canada to get Wolverine and the X-Men, or Sasquatch being possessed by the Great Beasts, or the death of Guardian, which we just sort of mentioned. So for me, the very first issue I ever bought was the Secret Wars 2 crossover, which was right in the middle of that switchover between Byrne and Mantlo. I had no idea what the hell was going on at all. But I was like, okay, this is okay. But that's the only one I bought. Then again, issue 87 comes around in June 1990, so you're done with your Poconos by this point. But they were doing a soft relaunch of the book with Fabian Nicieza kind of doing a new storyline. So I started there, but immediately bought all the back issues. So in 1990, I was burning through the back issue because you could get them out of quarter bins back then, and I was just reading tons of it. So that's when I would have read this was 1990.
Wow. Okay. I had no idea it ran that long. I had no clue it ran for hot. That's a respectable run, right? 130 issues
Oh
is nothing to sneeze.
yeah.
Aquaman never made it to 130.
Somewhere around,
I like to keep pointing out, I'm still
I
not over
know.
it.
I mean, if you add them up, maybe. But if at some point in the, I'm making numbers up here, guys, but somewhere in like the 50 or 50s or 60s in the run, it became a comic shop only book, and
Oh,
that's, I mean.
really?
Yeah,
Oh.
well, it was freaking awful, Rob. I mean, it was
Okay.
unreadable. It was so bad. And then it picks up again with issue 87, which was again that soft relaunch. I think it became newsstand again at that point. If I'm getting my facts wrong, people, you know what? It's the last episode. You can't really
Yeah,
complain.
no, this doesn't matter.
But it got better, and then it got significantly worse again. So it went through a lot of ups and downs this series. I love all of them, but there's some really low points for Alpha Flight.
Okay, all right, fair enough. So now you mentioned off air that you wanted to talk a little bit before we get into the comic about you have your own sort of version of Mountain Comics.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you've mentioned Mountain Comics on so many episodes, whether on this show or even you and I when we used to record together back in the dark ages of the internet. And I never really thought about it. I kind of have a few what I would call like road trip comics, right? I didn't go to the mountains. I would usually go to Michigan, honestly. We drive from Florida to Michigan to go visit family. But there's three particular comics that loom large in my mind as road trip comics. And those, so at this point, it's 1985, I was buying Firestorm, and I think Justice League, and that's it. That's the only DC comics I was reading. But I picked up, because of reasons, I picked up Crisis on Infinite Earths, issue number 6 and issue number 8 on the same day, in these little, what are you going, drugstores or whatever. Blew my mind. And that was the beginning of my lists, by the way, that you love so much too. I started writing Earth 1. Okay, this guy. Earth 6, Blue Beetle, whatever, or whatever that was. I don't remember. So that was the beginning of my lists right then and there. But then when we got to Michigan, I bought another comic. I bought Superpowers Volume 2, the infinitely superior volume. And about issue number 3, it featured Dr. Fate. And that began my love affair with Dr. Fate. So here on either it was one road trip or two, I don't know, either way on road trips, I fell in love with a bigger DC universe with Crisis, and I fell in love with Dr. Fate with Superpowers, and just brings me happy memories.
That's terrific. That's great. I wish everybody would have memories like that, of getting
Yeah.
comics in strange places and things like that. So, and it's starting to percolate, the comics are making it back into different stores, right? That are not comic stores. So that's great. Maybe the kids will have those experiences again. So, but okay, so we're here to talk about Alpha Flight number 4. It came out on August 16th, 1983, my 12th birthday.
Happy birthday.
Truly, thank you. It was truly the summer I turned pretty. The story is called Resolutions. It is by John Byrne. There's other credits, but who cares? It's just John Byrne. The cover features Marina strapped to a globe with a mysterious hand crunching it, and she doesn't look good for her. I love the confidence of this cover because there is no cover copy. It's just this image, right? Byrne is like, that's enough. That's enough for you to plunk down your 60 cents, kid. So what do you think of this cover?
Well, I love a lot of it because she's strapped to this globe, but she's upside down, which implies, sort of out of control. And they position her body in such a way you can see Canada pretty well, which is cool. And then the hand, which is obviously the master of the world, crumbling the world, which is great. The big bold red. I think it's a very strong cover. I don't know if it would make me separate from my 60 cents, But because I like, if I looked at this, I'm like, who the heck's this character? I don't know. But I think it's a very striking cover, and it certainly shows Jeopardy, and it shows the world in Jeopardy, which is great. And I have a revelation of being a fan since 1990, which means now what? What is that? 35 years?
Dear Lord.
I have never once thought of her name as Marina. I always called her Marina.
Oh, because it's like Submariner, I see.
Or but. A marina is the thing where you put boats in the water. Of course, her name's probably Marina, and I've just been saying it wrong all these years. I mean, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm right. I don't know, but I never thought of that. I'm like,
Well,
duh.
it's odd. I've always said Submariner, not Submariner, and that's the opposite of that. Although a mariner is like a mariner is a mariner. That's a nautical term. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I it's not like, unlike you, I didn't have school friends that read comic books. So it wasn't like I had lots of friends that we were sitting hearing these names out loud. I didn't
Darkseid,
know. I was the only
Darkseid,
person that read Alpha Flight.
Darkseid,
Yeah,
Darkseid,
Dark.
Darkseid, as we yelled across the playground at each other.
It's like a Norman Rockwell painting, your childhood. So, okay.
really was not like a Norman
Yes,
Rockwell
I
painting, I
know.
promise you
Yes, I know. No.
that.
I tried to write a synopsis and I got bored and stopped. So even for the final episode, I just couldn't do it. So I went and pulled this from Marvel Wiki and I edited it a little bit. I wanted to make sure I give credit to them because they deserve credit for this thing I'm about to read. So, okay. The Submariner and the Invisible Girl race toward the frozen north in the Fantastic Four's Fantastic Car. Namor expresses concern that a great evil lies within the territory that has been poisoning Atlantean waters and driving barbarian hordes further south. Suddenly, a laser array protrudes from a patch of ice and blasts the ship out of the sky. Meanwhile, Guardian and Sasquatch succeed in finding Aurora. However, the experience has traumatized her and she has regressed into her Jean-Marie persona. Jean-Marie rejects her fellow Alphans and takes off into another corridor. Sasquatch feels that he might be able to reach her in his human guise, so he shapeshifts back into the form of Walter Langowski. He catches up to her and, in an attempt to calm Jean-Marie down, recalls a secret past intimacy, but she grows enraged and backhands him across the face. The Submariner and the Invisible Girl eventually find an undersea entranceway into the Master's craft. Sue turns them both invisible, and they find the master of the world, great name, standing above the prostrate form of Marina. The master, as yet unaware of their presence, continues to tell Marina of her own mysterious heritage. We then get a kind of a long detail of Marina's origin of her people. The Submariner and the Invisible Woman descend into the master's chambers, recognizing that he could not hope to defeat the two heroes. In addition to wandering members of Alpha Flight, the master elects upon a speedy retreat. Vindicator, meanwhile, flies throughout the vessel, blasting as many instrument panels as he can find. The extensive damage begins to take its toll, and the ship starts to buckle. He manages to regroup with the rest of the team, as well as Namor, Sue, and Marina, and they evacuate the ship. The giant space vessel explodes, destroying a massive portion of the surrounding icy landscape. The Submariner invites Marina to come back to Atlantis with him so that they can research her alleged origins more conclusively. Marina accepts and says goodbye to Alpha Flight. Later, Guardian stops off in Newfoundland to tell Dan Smallwood, Marina's adoptive brother, that she is gone. Dan, who has nurtured a lifelong passion for the amphibious hero, is heartbroken. All right. So, wah wah. So, okay. Overall, what do you feel? What do you think about this issue?
If we're just doing big picture thoughts, I enjoy it, but it doesn't feel like there's a lot of substance there. I first of all, well, okay, I'm just gonna start getting into details. I
Sure,
don't
go
know.
ahead. Yeah.
So first, you mentioned earlier, Byrne, right? Writing, penciling, and inking. Oh my gosh, this book is gorgeous. I mean, this is Byrne at the peak of his power, so it's like it's impossible not to love every single page you look at because it's just him being amazing. But when I look at the story, I'm like, they just kind of showed up in this place and like three different groups of people, then they eventually all meet up and then they leave. So not a lot happens in there. And then in fact your recap mentions the Master of the World has to retreat. He does, but throughout the whole dialogue, it's like, this is exactly as I planned. So, I mean, I guess he planned to, quote unquote, blow up his own ship or whatever, because it doesn't actually get blown up, it comes back. But so I don't know about that. I thought that was a little strange. Before I go into more detail, what did you think of the issue?
Well, okay. As a if I had not been reading Alpha Flight to this point, and I was, because I bought it from the first issue through like I think 15 or 16 or whatever it was, if I had if this had been a true mountain comic where it was a one, like, oh, I never read this book before and I just got this one, I would probably would have been like, what the heck? Like, who are these characters? And I probably would have been like, oh, it's cool that like Sue Storm and Namor are in it, but they shouldn't because it's not their book. But because I was reading it, I was fully aware of what was going on in the book. I'm sure I was a lot more satisfied because these first 12 or 13, they're really not, I mean, I have to go through them all. Some of them are one and dones, but they really are, they do comprise like a giant whole, one giant sort of story. And so it's as a one and as a sort of beginning, middle, and end, it's okay. But that probably didn't bother me because I already knew what was happening and I planned to get the next issue.
Yeah. And also, we didn't know at the time, Byrne didn't want to do a team book. So all of these issues, for the most part, now this one's a bit of an exception. Most of them are a lot of standalone stories, and they are focusing on individual character. Like next issue five is just a Puck story. And issue three was mostly an Aurora story. And this one, I don't know, this one's mostly a, honestly, Submariner Invisible Girl story, really. Yeah, so like they don't really do much as a team until after issue 12 because Byrne didn't want to do another team book.
I
So I
remember his
will
number
say,
six with Snowbird is like the
yep.
all white issue where it's just
Yeah.
like
Wonder if he got paid the same page rate for that.
I'm sure he did.
So I, you mentioned also the issue is called Resolutions, and I tie that into my fussing about the story a bit. Like, I don't know that anything really got resolved here. I mean, we found out Marinus' origin, but I don't know what else really got resolved. So now, one thing to be critical about Byrne, one thing is, and really only one thing, is most of the issue has no backgrounds. It's a foreground image, and if you just flip through it quickly, you'll notice. Well, there's an occasion where there's something, but for the most part, there's no background to any of these pages. But I can't fault the guy because, again, he's writing it, he's penciling it. I didn't know that he was inking it too. He's inking it too. That's a lot of time. So, and he's doing the Fantastic Four book at the same time.
I
So
can't,
I'm not gonna fault him for it. But as I read it now, in a silo, I just couldn't help but notice, like, oh, there's all yellow background, there's all fuchsia background, there's all purple background, that kind of thing.
There's only really the one page where Sue and Namor get into the Masters of the World ship, and you see all the gears and all the machinery and all the James Bondy stuff. But yeah, there is a lot of just solid colors because he's just like, I got to get this done, right? I got to get
Yeah.
this done.
So are you looking at that page where they're with all the, okay, so she's like the top, they're in the water, or the second panel, they're invisible. Okay. She looks so much like Carol Marcus from Star Trek II, the Wrathicon on that page. Like, I can't unsee that Wrathicon look now. I knew you were one person who would appreciate
Yes, absolutely. What we did in there, we did in a day. I
that.
love, by the way, I love Sue Storm's Fantastic Four winter coat.
Yeah.
Like, I love all the Fantastic Four accoutrement. I love him doing Namor. I love the slightly square head he gives Namor.
Yeah,
That
yeah.
some artists did that, some others didn't. The Master of the World is kind of like definitely one of the, sorry, Chris, Morty characters out there. He looks cool, but. I mean, I know he says like this was my plan all along, but I don't know. I get the sense he's like, oh shit, things are getting out of hand. I'm getting out of here, whatever. I mean, he's never really that big of did he come back
Oh,
as an
all the
Alpha
time.
Flight?
He
Oh, did he?
he's kind of, well, yeah, he's kind of Alpha Flight's only villain, really. I mean,
Oh,
unless
really?
you count,
Oh,
well, unless
no.
you count like Pink Pearl or whatever, right?
Okay.
So I mean, they have a few. They have a handful of villains. The Master of the World's probably their biggest villain, but he's never that interesting. He's always, I mean, I think Byrne created him, but didn't know where he was gonna take him. And then everyone else has been kind of the same way. They're like, I think I'm gonna do this with him. And the next writer's like, I'll do this with him. So he's never really that interesting, but he is, yeah, he's definitely one of their big bads.
Okay, all right. There's a Vincent Price movie called Master of the World where he plays a megalomaniacal guy who wants to like bring peace to the world by destroying it, like
Oh.
basically destroying all of the world's war-making powers. And he
Okay.
does it, of course, the way you would do it via a dirigible. And so I have to wonder. Now, this guy doesn't really look like Vincent Price. Personally, you just see him in the helmet, but I have to wonder if that wasn't a slight influence or anything like that. But it's, like I said, it's a lot of fun. I liked these characters. I thought Byrne, I mean, he didn't create them. They first appeared in the X-Men. I think they're
Oh,
creations
he
of.
created them.
Oh, did
Him
he?
and Claremont together.
Oh,
But if I remember right, okay. Oh, I might be getting some facts wrong, but what the hell? Again, they can't complain. It's the last episode.
Yeah, no.
I'm pretty sure Claremont created Vindicator, right? Or
Okay.
Guardian, if you will. And then when it came time for the Alpha Flight group, I'm pretty sure he turned a lot of that over to John because John was from Canada, sort of, kind of. And so I think he turned a lot of it over to him. So I think they probably, I mean, I'm guessing, I think they probably both get co-creator credits, but I think Byrne had a lot to do with it.
Okay. All right. I agree that visually, I said it's great. I mean, again, now that you've mentioned it, the panels, I'm looking at the backgrounds. I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of these panels don't have any
Yeah, they're
backgrounds.
just not there.
And then there's the 2-page spread of the surface of the ice exploding, and it's like that didn't need to be 2 pages. It's okay. And okay, and now, because again, it's the last episode, who cares? Now that I'm on this train of thought, there's a sequence in Alpha Flight number 12 where I forget the villain, but one of the villains looks into oh shoot, who was the
Was it
mystic?
Smart Alec who looked into Shaman's bag
Shaman,
or
yeah. And he looks into Shaman's bag, and of course, something he gets the whammy put on him. And the whole bit is that he like freezes because of what he is seeing. And I remember that book because in those panels, Byrne didn't redraw the face across 3 panels. They just took the same panel and statted it 3 times. But the thing is, if you look at that third panel, like you could tell it's blown up. Like the resolution is bad. And it's like, oh, they didn't even bother to like
Oh my gosh.
do like a nice stat. I mean, they just literally took like a blown, it's like looking at like a YouTube video on a giant movie screen. All of a sudden it looks all pixelated. So I get no knock on John Byrne. The man cranked out material at an unbelievable rate. And as you said, this is at the peak of his powers. He's a like not long before he takes over Superman for Pete's sakes. He's gonna go on the Hulk shortly after this Alpha Flight run. I mean, I loved his stuff. He was one of the absolute people that if he was doing a book, I was buying it. So no knock on him at all. I appreciate the fact that he was at times, I'm sure he was just trying to get all the stuff out the door because the workload was so massive.
Writing and drawing both Fantastic Four and Alpha Flight, that's huge. That's a
Yeah.
huge ask. I mean, gosh, wow.
Yeah,
So there's
that
a
it
couple of
really
story
is.
things I want to mention. Like, there's a funny bit where they're explaining about Aurora's split personality, and Sasquatch actually calls Guardian out on that. He says, "Do you really think it was a good idea, recruiting someone with a split personality for our superhero team? You think that's stable?" So, I mean, without a doubt, Guardian definitely needed some HR help. Like, if you look at the makeup of this team, with Marina, who in issue 2 like eviscerates Puck. I mean, yeah, they need some HR help here, and it's not Heather either because she hires some really questionable recruits later as well. But they need an HR department, so definitely. And I
Listen.
do have a well, go
Oh,
ahead.
go ahead.
No, you.
I was just gonna say, I appreciate, I was just random notes. I appreciate that. And this issue, Namor keeps it pretty tight in terms of his ardor for Sue. Like they don't really get into that a whole lot.
There's one page that just it tickled me where they're talking and he's flirting with her and she knows it too. I can't find it, doesn't really matter. Anyway, he says something like, "Sue, everything you do is always more than efficient." She's like, "Flatterer," and she smiled and like, "Yeah, okay, yeah." Well, I want to ask you about that. So, is this more of a Fantastic Four comic or is this more of an Alpha Flight comic?
Because I mean, Alpha Flight gets a lot to do. We see a lot of, but yes, I think that because Sue and Namor are sort of driving the action, this does feel like the Alpha Flight maybe has sort of wandered into a Fantastic Four story or something. So, yeah.
I kind of feel the same as well. Yeah, definitely. Last big thoughts for me here is, so this is issue number 4. We covered issue 40, and if you've ever spent any time reading Alpha Flight, you know that it's always the damn Plodexes. This alien race that Marin, every time she shows up, it has to be a Plodex story. What is the weird balance that you and I have covered 2 Plodex stories now? I'm so tired of the Plodex always. So, and Marina leaves the team here, right? This is issue 4. They've already lost a main, introductory member of the team, and she never really returns as a featured full-time member. I mean, there's times where she shows up, but she's never really a full-time member of Alpha Flight again, at least in this first run. She's kind of the member everyone forgot.
I don't think I remember that she'd ever, well, like I said, I only read it through 13 or 14. She doesn't come back, essentially.
No, I mean, like, she'll show up for certain stories, and then there'll be like some mini series, like after the first run, where they'll put her on the team, but that's like a 12 issue mini series. It's not one, it's just done. But other than that, like, yeah, she's never really, and if she is back, she's never really that active. So, yeah. And it's sort of interesting, this issue, she leaves with Namor. You and I covered issue 40, where they get married.
Oh
So,
God, I forgot about that.
or they either got married there or they left to go get married. One or the other. I can't remember, but maybe the marriage happened in Avengers comic. I can't remember. But the connectivity between these two random comics you got in the mountains. Maybe those convenience stores in the mountains only stock Plodex comics. Maybe that's what it is.
Yes, I'm sure the newsstand vendor in the Poconos was reading these comics closely and stocking them to so thematically they stayed consistent. I'm sure that they were
Excellent.
thinking about that. Yeah.
I love the consistency. Good,
Yeah.
good.
No, it's said it's a lot of fun. Again, this is it's not the kind of mountain comic that I think about when I started the show and that it was a one and done and that I was like, oh, I never bought this before. Let me try it, or I didn't like it, or I did like it. This was something like Batman or Justice League or Star Wars or Brave and the Bold, where I was like, I got it every month. I'll get it while I'm at the Poconos. But I loved all these original Alpha Flights. And reading this again was fun. Again, it's not one of my favorites because, as you mentioned, the stuff Marina was always kind of like, eh, all right, not one of my favorite characters. But nevertheless, it's still a lot of fun. And it was great to look at because, again, Byrne is just cooking on all cylinders here.
Yeah, and any criticism I've thrown at this is coming from a place of love. I mean, I
Yeah.
live and breathe Alpha Flight. Right above my left shoulder on top of a bookcase, I have the bust, like the Randy Bowen bust of every single member of Alpha Flight. I've
Wow.
got t-shirts with Alpha Flight. I mean, I'm all in, folks. So
Wow.
I say all this with love in my heart.
I have to tell you, everybody, that when Chegg and I were prepping this issue, this episode, a while back, he was like, "What are we covering?" I forgot because we had talked about this a while back,
Oh, I
and
didn't know where you're
I
going.
typed it. I typed it at like 4 in the morning because I was up walking the dog early, and I typed Alpha Flight, but I hadn't realized I wasn't looking closely, and I typed Aloha Flight, which is a perfect typo to make because it suggests another whole team of heroes in a very different setting. This is Canada's super team, and then I'm like, Aloha Flight could be the Hawaiian super team. That would be kind of fun to read.
Exactly. And I think it was autocorrect that caught you because that happened to me too. I was typing Alpha Flight earlier and it changed it to Aloha Flight. I was like, what? So I think it's autocorrect. But that took me down a whole path of changing superhero teams by changing one letter. So I have a few more to share if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
Instead of the Avengers, you change the G and you get Avenuers. So it's like a team of like kid superheroes that live on an avenue and they protect their avenue. They're the Avenuers. X-Men, change out the X to an A, and you get A-Men. It's a religious-themed superhero team that run around. Instead of the Doom Patrol, you get the Boom Patrol. They're out there maybe like on an Air Force base when the sonic booms come. They go make sure everybody's
Well,
okay.
maybe they're in fourth world team.
Oh, that's good. The Boom Patrol. Oh, I love that. That's clever. And then instead of Power Pack, you get Lower Pack. So like when you go to the cigarette machine in the 1970s, you don't want the Marlboros. You want the one below it. You want the Lower Pack.
Okay. All
I
right. That's
spent
fair.
far too much time on the back porch playing with letters the other day, trying to come up with more of these.
I appreciate the effort. I really do. So, that's Alpha Flight number 4. It was always something I kind of wanted to get to, and it was always in my intention to have you back on the show. So, thank you for coming back one last time, sir.
I appreciate it. Now, I do have some thoughts as
Yes.
you begin to close out the show here. I went back and I listened to several older episodes of the series
Oh,
of
wow.
Mountain Comics, and I listened to some more recent ones, and I realized something. We talked a lot faster back in the old days.
Did we
Like,
really?
yeah, because
Okay.
I listened to everything at like 1.6 speed or 1.7 speed. And like the first few episodes, like I'm holding on, just I'm catching every word, but it's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then I listen to more recent episodes and it just sounds like two people talking. It's like,
Well, we're getting old. We're older,
we're getting
man.
old.
I mean, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. We're getting older.
We're 11. What? We're 14. Wait, when did we start doing this? We're
Well, I don't know.
14 years older than when we started.
This is true. This is true. Then episode one, I went back and specifically listened to that one. And I don't know if you remember, I decided to give a TED talk all about Alpha Flight during that episode and
That
tell
sounds
you
right.
Right, thank you. And talk about like the good periods of Alpha Flight and the bad periods of Alpha Flight. And I ramble for quite a while. And you even like joked like you're regretting inviting me for the first episode and all this stuff. But I went back and looked. With all of that rambling, that episode was still only 27 minutes long.
Is it
It was. It
really?
is one of the shortest episodes of this series
Wow.
ever. Subsequent episodes sometimes went three times as long.
Yeah.
So I believe I'm owed an apology for my TED talk about Alpha Flight and being too long, sir.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't think any of that. I know, well, I guess the first couple were short. I remember the second episode Ryan and I did live
Okay.
from the hotel at Boston Comic Con when we went to Boston that time, and that episode's probably pretty short. But yeah, they definitely expanded pretty quickly. Holy geez, 27 minutes. I didn't realize that.
Still waiting for that apology. Still waiting.
Okay, well, you'll be waiting quite a while.
Okay.
So,
And oh no, I got one more thing.
okay.
I'm folks, on the last episode, I am here to reveal to you that this entire show is built on a stack of lies. So, because Rob always says, there's nothing to do in the mountains. There's nothing to do in the mountains. You have to have these comics. It's so because there's nothing to do.
Well, that was my perspective when I was 10.
I call you a liar in your own show theme music. The commercial for the Poconos Resort, they
Yeah, Manary Lodge, yes.
say headline entertainment right there in the message. There is headline entertainment for you, Robin, and it is not Alpha Flight number 4. I don't know what it is, but you had opportunities to do things.
Do you know what they considered headline entertainment in 1970? It was like Bob Goulet coming and singing. I mean, no knock on Bob
Bob
Goulet, but
Goulet, they would have been
I
amazing.
wasn't interested in that when I was 10. So that's yeah. No, I was an inside kid, and I still mostly am an inside kid. So that's when I say there was nothing to do. It was, because I didn't want to go and do stuff. I was like, I don't want to. No, I don't want to do that. I'll just read my comics. It's fine.
Your
So,
podcast is built on a house of lies.
well, take it up with everybody can complain, and I'll. Oh, wait, I'm not doing another episode. So too bad, everybody. Well, okay, Shag. Before we sign off, I will let you plug a little. So what are we working on here on the network?
You and I do Who's Who Review together, where we just continue to mine something that we desperately don't want to lose our base with, where we go back and talk about old entries from Who's Who, and we produce that about 4 times a year. Independently of Rob, thank goodness, I have my own JSA in the 90s show where I talk about the Justice Society. Oh, come on. Justice Society of America, as published in the 1990s. I have a Once Upon a Geek where I can talk about whatever I want to talk about, including Blue Devil or Star Trek or whatever I feel like, Back to the Future, whatever I want to talk about. And then I do a podcast about Star Wars, which is Marvel Star Wars from Empire to Jedi, where I'm specifically talking about the best run of Star Wars, which is the old Marvel comics that were published literally between Empire and Jedi, and having a blast doing those as well.
All right, very good. And I look forward to guesting on the Star Wars show at some point.
I know, I'm excited. I can't believe I have a show that you're actually going to be on. Wow.
I've been on every one of. All right, okay,
You've never been on my. Well, I guess we did JSA together at first, so I guess that
No,
counts.
we have. Well, okay, but the show's still going. But I mean, I was on JLI a couple times. I mean, come on, what are we?
Don't tell anyone I said this, but you were on JLI more than anyone else.
Yeah, you were on
Because we.
Stolen Water a bunch of times.
Yep.
What are we doing? I invited you on MashCast. You turned me down. So,
That is true.
what are
That
you
is
talking
true.
about?
You're
So,
right. You're right.
anyway, well, again, thank you so much for coming back. I had no other plan to end the show other than with you. So, thank you for doing it. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And thank you for asking me the question you ask everyone else. You didn't. Yoo-hoo, by the way, I drank a ton of Yoo-hoo in my youth, and I would love to join you for a Yoo-hoo, but I will warn you up front, I am lactose intolerant, so you've been warned.
Well, luckily, there is no dairy in you. It's just chocolate.
I just Googled it and it said there is.
I think talk about a throne of lies. I don't think there's anything. Whatever. I don't think there's much dairy in a Yoo-hoo. Let me just put it that way. So,
That's fair.
well,
Okay.
all right. Well, that's good. I appreciate that. After all the hate that Yoo-hoo takes from Brett Young, I appreciate someone's coming on and saying they enjoy it. I have to say, every time I've explained it to someone who's never had it, they look at me like, "What the hell? Why would you drink that?" Like I remember I would tell my wife about it, and she's like, "What is it?" I'm like, "Well, it's like chocolate milk, but no milk. It's more watery." And she just looks at me like,
I know. There's no good way to explain it. You're
No,
right.
it doesn't sound good at all. So,
All right,
well,
so are cans, juice pack, pouches, or the glass bottle?
oh, glass bottle.
Absolutely.
Glass
Has to be
bottle.
the
Come
glass
on.
bottle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to
Okay.
have some level of presentation to this. So, well, anyway, thank you so much. I want everybody to stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos. Shag will come back later on after I've wrapped up the show. We'll crack open some Yahoos together. But I'm going to come back solo and do some listener feedback over the last, for the comments over the last season. And I'm going to close up the cabin. So stay tuned, everybody.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away. During the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Worlds would live.
Worlds would die.
And DC Comics would never be the same again.
Crisis on Infinite Earths, the crossover so epic it reached every corner of the DC multiverse. Join DC Dave
and Doug Adamson as we discuss The Monitor Tapes,
a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast.
Find us on your favorite podcatcher and join the discussion at themonitortapes.com.
And we're back. And as I mentioned, we're going to be covering the feedback we got on the previous episodes of the season, because as everyone knows, this is the last episode. I wanted to make sure these comments, at least the attention they deserve, before we wrap up the show here. So obviously I'm not going to be able to read everything, because the show got actually a heavier amount of comments than it normally does, which is great. I really appreciate it. So I'm going to mention a few, but everyone is going to get mentioned at some point. So let's go back to the first episode of the season, which was episode 53, where we talked about Avengers number 225 with my guest, Sean Ross. We got comments from Brian Chufo, Rob McCarthy, Edo Boznar, Bucky749, Dr. Ange, Movie Matt Sirois, Paul Ken, Chris Franklin, Brett Young, Tim Price, and Martin Gray, who says, "You chaps are so right. This cover is so brilliant." And the next was equally excellent. "I always liked the Black Knight's dashing look, although I didn't like that Dane Whitman was American. It just felt wrong. I don't have the original Hulk comic copies with me to check, but I'm pretty sure the story is continuing Dane's adventures from Marvel UK, in which he and Captain Britain were slung into the past. That bit where Dane remarks, 'A pretty good summary, Hawkeye, except that it's 5 years out of date,' seems to be the clincher. If I'm wrong, I know Chris Lewis, Matt Eves, Jimmy McGlinchey, Cymbal Penny, Doug Abinson, or some other Brit can put me right. I actually think Greg Lovok's work looks better here under veteran artist Chick Stone than it often did at DC. What's this printer? Kinko? Kenko? And what's the plan B that was mentioned? Questions, questions. Rob, your Spider-Man Home Alone idea is brilliant. Incidentally, has any reason been given as to why the current Spidey films have home in the title?" And then my guest Sean Ross responds with Martin, "Kinko's was a 24-hour copier store. Yes, it was. I actually worked there on the overnights for 6 months. It after 5.5 months of that job, it was the closest I ever came to an actual mental breakdown. But that's a story for another day. Plan B is a pill a woman can take within 72 hours of sexual activity to avoid pregnancy. I actually think my idea of a one-off episode on strangest jobs would be fun, just based on what Rob and I have experienced, much less what the other folks would add. Can you imagine what weirdness Shag would bring?" Well, we'll have to ask him. Yeah, I think that would be a fun episode to do, right? All the Fire and Water Network's members' weird jobs. That's something we may have to consider. Anyway, so regarding episode 54, Tales to Astonish number 12 with my guest Michael Bailey, got comments from Martin Gray, Timothy Drake, Ryan Daly, Chris Franklin, Mark Baker Wright, Brett Young, Tim Price, and Brian Chufo, who says, "Another fun episode. All those reprint issues were an important part of our comics history lessons. Marvel Tales, when it started reprinting the early Spider-Man issues, gave me a real appreciation for early Marvel. I have vivid memories of Drac Pack, They were teenage versions of Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, and the werewolf doing superhero stuff with their monster powers. Strangely, the werewolf had super breath, and the vampire could turn into a cloud? I don't remember a single story plot, but it probably didn't matter. Ado Boznar says, excellent conversation, gentlemen, on the topic of the newer late 70s, early 80s reprint titles. Regardless of the backroom reasons for doing them, were the young me loved them. As a diehard X fan, I was loving the reprints of the early X-Men and Amazing Adventures, while the reprints of Submariner and Tales to Astonish, together with the reprints of Silver Surfer and the revised fantasy masterpieces, were particularly favorites because of all the lovely John Buscema art. No offense to Marie Severin, of whose work I became a big fan of later, but I dropped Tales to Astonish once the Buscema-drawn issues were over. Of course, as you noted, Marvel pulled the plug on it not long afterward anyway. Also, I was another fan of the track pack, although I hardly remember the details of any single episode now. I watched it pretty religiously back then, and it included what I still think is the best ever acronym for an association of evildoers, OGRE, standing for Organization of Generally Rotten Enterprises. Chef's kiss. You know, the track pack, if track pack has ever come back, that feels like something some movie studio could revive, because that's all IP nowadays. Regarding Mountain Comics episode 55, Fantastic Four number 235 with my guest Cisco, I'd got comments from Ado Boznar, Brian Chufo, Chris Franklin, Movie Matt Rice, David S. Gutierrez, Paul Ken, and Sean Ross, who says, Robin Ciscoid, great episode, guys. I especially love Ciscoid's story about his shared custody comics. I think we all flummoxed our parents when we were younger with our unusual requests for comics and toys. I distinctly remember having a no, Hammerhead is not a shark conversation with my mom at one point. As a parent of a manga junkie, it is now my turn in the hot seat. You would think my comic collecting would prep me for the job, but I still barely know My Hero Academia from Chainsaw Man. You know, it's funny you say that, Sean. I was in a bookstore once, and I was in the comic section. It was a Second and Charles, which has is like a used bookstore, but it's huge, and it was housed in an old Border, so you could, you know, that's how big it was. And I was in the comic section, and there was a young man there, a young boy, he was like 13, 14, and he was with his grandmother, and he was looking for a particular kind of manga. And I think he might have been looking for My Hero Academia because he was trying to explain to his grandmother what the name of this book was, and she just could not understand it because, of course, so many manga titles, when they're translated into English, kind of don't make sense, right? They don't, you know, they don't have like, they don't follow like English noun, verb, predicate kind of thing. And so she's like, what are you looking for? And he's like getting more and more frustrated. And I remember him yelling something, My Hero Academia, like you would say Coca-Cola. Like it was some, grandma, how dumb can you be? It's My Hero Academia. And the poor woman just looked so flummoxed. I don't know if the kid ever got his My Hero Academia, but I just remember that, how frustrated he sounded. Anyway, my condolences that you're in the hot seat now with your kids when it comes to that stuff. We also got a comment from Tim Price, who says, this issue was during the period when I was just starting to buy new comics, but not full on collecting yet. And I happened to pick this one up. It wasn't long after I started collecting for me to keep Burns FF as a regular buy. And after discovering comic shops and conventions, I backfilled the whole run as best I could. But I did get this issue right off the stands, and wow, I loved it, and it freaked me out. Normally, the second part would be a deal breaker because I was so sensitive. Not like now, uh-huh. The artwork just kept me rereading it, and I marveled at the comics history that played into the story, and the stunning conclusion. Is it any wonder that this run is beloved today? I wonder how many other people read this issue without reading the previous one at the time. The tone of the story changes a lot with the context, because as far as the FF know, Earth has been devastated by Ego's gravity and millions dead, and they're basically on a desperate mission to safeguard the survivors, not knowing all of that destruction has been magically undone. They can't even be sure things haven't gotten worse while they're away. As a reader of the second issue originally, I didn't have any of that knowledge, and it doesn't distract from the story, but knowing these details elevates the issue even more. So I'd love to hear who read FF 234 before 235, or who just read 235, or any poor souls who only read 234, because dang, what a cliffhanger to be left on. Talking about After Burn, there was a very brief period written by Roger Stern before Englehart stepped in, but a sadly forgettable run, which is a shame because I usually enjoy Stern's work. Alas, his job seemed to be editorially prescribed to bring Ben back into the team and ditch She-Hulk, so it had nothing to make it stand out, except for one bit where they're slugging it out with the She-Hulk shouts, it's clobbering time, and Ben is incensed. She Bogarted his catchphrase. It ends amicably, but that part does tickle me. Between Avengers last month and FF now, you're hitting all my sweet spots, Rob. Well, I'm glad I could do that for you in this final season, Tim. Mount Comics 56. Conan the King, number 25, got comments. With my guest Tom Panarese, got comments from Ado Boznar, Bucky 749, Lizanne Oswald, and Network All-Star Brett Young, who says, 12-year-old Rob in a cabin with Yoo-Hoo reading Conan the King. Golly, that Conan sure does like some pretty ladies, but he sure is clumsy. I'm not from Mayberry. He keeps falling down on ladies, and their clothes pop off. You think those gals would tie their clothes tighter, seeing how they aren't wearing much? Oh, good, that Leonidas fellow is helping that lady with her dress to make sure it's on proper. Good story, well off to the fishing hole. Again, I didn't fish. I'm not okay, Brett. David Gutierrez says, Rob, I own this comic. I think my father bought it at a garage sale or some such. First off, the black dragons were always cool, but how does a ninja factor into that time? So strange, but awesome. I can't help but wonder how much this title was like a soap opera. I guess it was the romantic entanglements that were broader than just who Conan slept with that issue. Another great job, just like that last Conan magazine you covered with that rakishly handsome guest. I don't remember who that was. Regarding Mad Comics 57, Night Force number 4 with my guest, fellow Network All-Star Ryan Daly, got comments from Rob McCarthy, Super Captain, Movie Matt Sirois, Ado Boznar, Sean Ross, Dr. Ange, Flanger, Martin Gray, Paul Kien, Captain Entropy, who says, great job, All-Stars. I'm behind on my podcast listening, especially my comments. However, I really enjoy this podcast, despite not enjoying the one or two issues of Night Force I picked up. I have a relative who works at a food bank. He recently met a woman who claimed to have been involved in the U.S. intelligence community's psionic experiments that ended before she was born. She was also claimed to have been off planet. Wow. And admitted to some familiarity with the show Stranger Things. I believe one of those assertions. Anyway, because of that extensive pedigree, I feel qualified to comment on the Cold War and the paranormal in fiction. I think these kinds of stories resonated with people for a few reasons. First, the Cold War seemed like something out of a comic book or sci-fi movie. It was, at least on one level, a Manichean struggle between good versus evil. Vast national resources were devoted to secret missions and new high-tech weapons. Once, one of my daughters asked me a series of questions about the Cold War. Were we really in a race to the moon against the Soviets? Yes. Did each side really have enough nuclear weapons to blow up the world? Yes. Did we really fight proxy wars and hunt each other's spies? Yes. But the Soviets never really had a program to train little girls into ballerina assassins like in the Marvel movies? Pause while I search my memory. No, not as far as I know. So processing all this through the lens of actual comic books and movies makes perfect sense. I think part of what we were processing was not only the threat, but what they also might do to us, but also what we were doing to fight them. By that, I mean how much of what we did was justified and where the line we couldn't cross and still be the good guys was. Oh, that's long ago, those days. Even though Night Force didn't grab me as a child, it's clear from the story that it was a work of significant skill and labor by masters at their craft, and it was exploring important themes. I forgot one point. Ryan was right that it was made all creepier because they looked like the majority of Americans ethnically, so they could therefore be infiltrators. It also made them more difficult to dehumanize and other. But the fact that the Russians and the East Germans were European was an important difference. They were from older cultures, and in the case of the Russians, a more mystical one that had only a new and tenuous grasp on modernity. Plenty of creep factor and fodder for hoodoo stories there. That's great. That's great stuff, Captain. That's wonderful observations. And then he concludes with, oh, and Rob, in case I get distracted next month, I'll say it now. Thanks for sharing pieces of your childhood with us. It was a blast. Well, thank you, Captain. And thank you so much for listening to the show. Jonathan says, in August 82, I had the flu or something. So my brother bought me 5 DC comics. Nice brother. The most comics I'd ever gotten at once at that point. So based on that memory, I eventually decided to get all the 8 82 DCs, which is how I got this, my only Night Force. And this week I went to a Poconos comic shop for the first time. They have dollar boxes. The awful New Jersey comic shops I was stuck with haven't had dollar boxes for 20 years. That's fantastic. I love it. Thanks for that, Jonathan. I really appreciate it. Fellow Network All-Star Chris Franklin says, fun episode, guys, but if Ryan makes me write synopses that long for Nightcast 2.0, well, we may have to unrevive it. I think I said this when Ryan and Hicks were covering Night Force, but at the time, all plainclothes people turned me off. And honestly, so did the art of Gene Colan. I accepted him on Batman because it was Batman. And even as a snot-nosed Brett, I could see his art fit the character. Thankfully, I have better taste now. I'm really going to miss the show and both versions of the jingle, but I know there are only so many vacations and so many comics. Oh, and Wuss, I will have you know I prefer the term wiener to describe my younger Freddy Cat self. I apologize, because I didn't mean to use the wrong W word to insult you. Eric leaves a very long comment, and I really kind of can't read it all, but I wanted to get as much of it in as I could because I found it really interesting. So he says, with Mountain Comics coming to an end soon, I thought I'd share a bit of nostalgia of my own and remember some of the comics I got during my own childhood family vacations. In my case, Beach Comics. Here it goes. And so he lists a bunch of comics that he got, like Uncanny X-Men number 107, his first ever X-Men comic, Miss Marvel number 12, Scary Tales number 36. This issue had some good horror stories with art by Pat Boyette and Tom Sutton, but the most memorable element was the cover by young Mitch O'Connell, who hadn't yet developed his trademark retro style, showing a green monster crashing through a window and startling a negligee-clad blonde. Yes, this was one of the comics that triggered my puberty. I had no idea that Mitch O'Connell ever did anything for Charlton. That was amazing. Beyond the Grave, number 17, another Charlton anthology, all reprints from the 70s. This one stuck in my memory due to the story No Way Out by Nick Cudi and Joe Staten about an agoraphobic writer modeled on H.P. Lovecraft, although I didn't know that at the time, who's so traumatized that he literally can't see the doors of his mansion. He thinks the other people, like the delivery boy who brings his groceries, can walk through walls. The sad twist ending comes when he finally breaks through his mental block and sees the doors again. Now he can leave through any door he wants, but he can't decide which one. I later found a copy of the original Ghostly Haunts issue the story is reprinted from, and I got that issue signed by Joe Staten when I saw him at a convention. That's how much I enjoyed it. That sounds really, really, really cool. I dig that. I've never read any of that. I don't think I've read a single issue of Beyond the Grave. He also mentioned Swamp Thing number 41, his introduction to Alan Moore. And then last one, Charlton Action number 11. I went into this newsstand that you shopped at, Eric, that had so many Charltons. I only knew of like one newsstand that ever had them. He says, Steve Ditko anthology featuring one of Ditko's better later day creations, Static. I found the whole book highly entertaining, although the part that stood out to me was the bizarre coloring decision to give the villain blonde hair but a red mustache. Ah, that Charlton quality. Thanks for letting me take this long trip down memory lane. Thank you, Eric. That's great. I loved reading your comment and your memories of all those particular books. That's really fantastic stuff. And like I said, even in the Poconos, where I was desperate for every comic I could get my hands on. I mean, sometimes I bought Archie and Harvey for Pete's sakes. I still don't remember finding a lot of Charltons. I think to my memory, there was one newsstand in my hometown of Cherry Hill, New Jersey, that would get Charltons, but that was about it. So they were hard to find. So man, I'm amazed you managed to find three of them. Even if you didn't find them all at the same time, the fact you found three at all to remember them was amazing. And then the final comment for the final episode of Mountain Comics goes to fellow Network All-Star Brett Young, who says, great show, Robin Ryan. Never read Night Force, but you're right that it probably would have made a good 10 p.m. Network series. In case I don't get to it in the next episode, I want to say how much I've enjoyed Mountain Comics. Such a great idea for a show. That Mount Airy Lodge jingle will never leave my brain. It was always a fun look back at a certain time period in comics, and I was proud to be a guest once myself. I think this was the second show I binged on the network after Treasury Cast. Be proud of what you've done here, Rob. It will be missed. Well, thank you, Brett. I appreciate it. And thanks, everyone, for the nice comments. And this show was always, you know, such a... I mean, you know, all these podcasts are kind of a weird little niche thing that we just all want to do. And we hope that there's an audience. But this one was even like nichier than most because it really was just a random collection of comics that had no real through line to any of them other than the fact where I bought them. And it was I'm not going to say I was worried about it. I wasn't worried about it, but I doubted that connection, because it was so personal to me, would resonate to anybody who hadn't had the same experience. But of course, a lot of you have had some experiences. Shay just talked about in the opening segment about buying comics on car trips when he was driving back to Michigan. And, you know, Siskoid this season talked about it a little bit as well. And other people have about that they had their own version of this. So I figured that would translate. And I'm happy to know that it did. The show was always, you know, like high. I mean, all the shows that I do are personal to me because they're about something that I love. But this one was always like especially so because those comics, like I've said many, many times, were so personal to me. A lot of the comics on my spinner rack to my right as I'm recording this are the same copies that I bought off the stands. I've held on them for 40 years and they've traveled with me from numerous places that I've lived. They've suffered through numerous relationships like myself, and they've remained with me. And it was great to be able to kind of dust them off metaphorically and give them new light and give them a chance to kind of talk about them and get into why they were so important to me. So I really appreciate you all who listened to this show. It really meant a lot to me. And, you know, I never end any of my podcasts lightly because in our modern world where we are besieged with information and entertainment, we're overloaded in it. The fact that anything anybody does gets someone else's attention is pretty remarkable. And for people to spend an hour of once a month or 45 minutes once a month listening to this, me rambling about some ancient comic that I bought 40 years ago that's meaningful to me but can't possibly necessarily be meaningful to anybody else is really, you know, it's really, really very touching. And so I really do appreciate that you all stuck with me for the 58 episodes of this show. And it's only because just life is changing. And I looked at the list of Mountain Comics that I had. And while there were a bunch of books that I knew that I bought, I had no memory of them connected to the Poconos. Like I knew that I had them. I just know it. But I didn't have any particular memory of where I got them or memory of sitting on the porch reading them the way I did some other ones. And so that's when I just thought, well, now that we're in, like, I think this is what, the seventh season of the show. I was like, I think it's time to just, you know, sort of again metaphorically close up the cabin. So it feels like the time is right to put a point in the end of the sentence. So before we wrap up, there's going to be a long list, but I just want to do a quick thank to every guest that we have had. I don't know why we do that. That I have had on Mountain Comics. I really do appreciate all the conversations I've had, and some people were nice enough to come on multiple times, but I want to thank everyone at least who came on at least one time in the course of this series. So again, long list, everybody, but stick with me. We're almost at the end. Thanks to the Irredeemable Shag, Ryan Daly, Michael Bailey, Chris Franklin, Dan Greenfield, Michelle Fife, J.M. DeMatteis, Max Romero, Zoom Yukinori, Derek William Crabb, Gene Hendricks, Greg Arujo, Jerry Conway, Sean Ross, Jared Albrick, Dr. Ange, Mike Gillis, Lucien Tassar, Roy Thomas, Tom Panarese, Keith Bowman, Martin Gray, Tim Price, Matt Sirois, Joe Duffy, Paul Kien, Down Baumgarten, Danny Fingeroth, Laurel Phillips, Captain Entropy, Dan Budnick, Bradley Austin Null, Paul Kupperberg, Henry Bernstein, Brett Young, Terry O'Malley, Sean M. Myers, Dr. Chris Lewis, Chuck Dill, Mike Jameson, David Ace Gutierrez, Adam McCarron, Scott X, and Siskoid. I deeply appreciate all you people who came on to talk with me on the show. And of course, an absolute thrill to have J.M. DeMatteis and Jerry Conway and Danny Fingeroff and Joe Duffy and Roy Thomas to come on to talk about it. I remember writing emails to all these people trying to explain what this show was and thinking, does this make sense at all to anybody? And maybe it didn't, but they all did the show anyway. And again, I very much appreciate it. So that's pretty much going to do it. Of course, you can still find me over on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. If you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, you go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So one last salute to the supporters of Mountain Comics, in this case, Neil Whitney, Chuck Dill, and for the very last episode, Captain Entropy, getting in it just under the wire there, Captain. Thank you so much for the support, and you guys are now free to go and support other shows across the network now that we're on our final episode. So that is really going to do it. Again, thank you all for listening. Thanks to Irredeemable Shag for coming back one last time. I loved being able to bookend the show the way I did, where I had Shag on and then Ryan, and then I ended it with Ryan and Shag. That just sort of made sense to me. This was a real blast. And currently, I do, as everyone knows, I do a movie show, Fade Out, and I'm working on another season of MASHcast. But after this, other than the quarterly Who's Who that Shag and I do, I will not have an ongoing comic book podcast. I have an idea for another one that fits, as I've gone on and on about. I don't want to do synopses anymore. I just don't have it in me to do it. And while I don't want to, like, I don't like backdoor pilots, I don't want to talk about another show. I want to give this show the proper send off. Anyone who's listening, in case you know, for some reason you were interested in still hearing me talk about comic books, I do have another idea that is percolating in my head. And maybe when the time is right, I will launch that And because there's going to be people who I want to keep talking to and have them on one of my shows that are just never really going to be the right guest for like a movie podcast or a MASH podcast. They're more like my comic friends, sort of. And I don't want to lose those associations. And so having another comics podcast would be a way to kind of keep those relationships going. And so I have an idea. I said, I think I might be able to pull off maybe sometime next year or something like that. Stay tuned. Obviously if I decide to do it, we'll announce it on the Fire and Water Podcast Network next year, by the way, which will be our 10th anniversary of the network, which is amazing. So anyway, that is really going to do it. Thank you all for listening. As I mentioned, after the credits roll, Shag and I will be cracking open some Yoo-Hoos together. We're going to watch the sun go down. So I'm going to close up the cabin and just thank you all one more time for listening, and be well. Bye.
Have a summer of fun in the Poconos. At your host with the most in the Poconos.
Every kind of summer fun at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Beautiful rooms, fabulous food, headline entertainment. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and
beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.